For this evening, I wanted to talk on a topic that I've never really talked about before, which is the topic of how the Buddha learned to meditate. Okay, so I know that there are a few people here who are quite new to Buddhism and don't know very much about Buddhism and the background of it. So we're going to learn a little bit about Buddhist history in tonight's talk. And we're going to look at how the Buddha learned to meditate himself. And we're going to ask the question, but what does it matter to me? Maybe this is all just going to be stories of a past bygone age that actually has no meaning for your life. I hope not, but maybe. But we should be good inquirers and not make assumptions about things beforehand. Anyway, so let's a bit of a background on the Buddha. So the Buddha lived in India, northern India, on the border of what is today Nepal, around 2,500 years ago. He was brought up in a upper class family, an aristocratic family of what's called the Sakyan clan. And they were the leading clan in the Sakyan Republic. So in those days in ancient India, you had basically two forms of governance. One was a monarchy, and then the other was a aristocratic republic. So basically what that meant was rule by the leading clans would elect a leader who would lead them for a period of time. And so that's the kind of environment that the Buddha grew up in. Now, I won't go too much into details about his younger life or anything like that, but there is one episode which was very important and which is consistently remembered throughout all the Buddhist traditions, and that is that when the Buddha was a boy, or before he was the Buddha, he sat down under a tree and meditated just spontaneously and went into what later in Buddhism we call the first jhana, or the first absorption, or the first level of deep meditation. So he just did that as a boy without any training, without doing any meditation method, without having guided meditations on an app, without listening to all of the teachers on YouTube, without reading all of the books. And did the fact that he didn't have all those things make it harder or easier? Hard to say, isn't it? Yeah, hard to say. So if we just kind of pause on that moment in the Buddha's life and then ask ourselves, well, what's going on with that? I mean, is this just a legend? Is this just something that you make up? Maybe, right? But to be honest, I don't really think so. I don't think it's a legend because, for a start, just from textual grounds, because it's preserved consistently throughout all the different Buddhist traditions. But more importantly to me is that it's not an uncommon thing. Or it might be uncommon, but it's certainly not unheard of. And I know a number of people who have had similar experiences and who have gone into deep meditation more or less spontaneously without having really any meditation background or training or anything like that. I could just give you one story. It was from one of the gentlemen who helped look after me when I was staying in Malaysia, in Ipoh, Chong, and he was just a very, you know, basic working class guy, drove a taxi, and he drove this beat up old taxi. The speedo didn't work, half of the windows didn't wind up, and all of these kinds of things. One day he says to me, "Oh yeah, but I have to go in and renew my taxi license." I said to him, "Chong, how are you going to renew your license on that thing?" And he just laughed. He said, "Bante, you know, in Malaysia, if I went to the car dealer and got the latest model Mercedes-Benz and drove that to get my taxi license, then I wouldn't pass unless I paid a little bit of money under the counter. But if you pay that little bit of money under the counter, well, even this one, you can get through just fine." So that's how it goes. So you think that the taxi licensing system was corrupt, but of course it was all monitored by the police. So the police would park outside of the taxi licensing place. So when you got your taxi license, the police would stop you outside and pick you up for driving a taxi that wasn't roadworthy, even though you just got your license, and then you'd have to pay them off as well. So that's how that went. So if you're ever driving, having to catch a taxi in Malaysia, good luck, that's all I can say. Anyway, so Chong was one of the guys who had started this little place that I was staying in, and he'd got this interest in meditation. He really wanted to learn how to meditate. And Ipoh is, like, if you know Malaysia at all, you know that Ipoh is like a Chinese town. And so there's a lot of the Mahayana temples around and so on. And so he went round to these different Mahayana temples trying to find somebody to teach him meditation. And he couldn't find. Everyone was just going, they go, they chick, 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 and they offer some incense and they prayed for, you know, wealth or good exam results or something like that. And no one's really practicing Dhamma. So eventually he came to one monastery, found a monk, asked him. His monk didn't really know anything, and he got so frustrated. He thought, oh, just give up now, you know, just give up. I'll just sit and meditate here. And it was like the worst place to meditate. It was this hall in this temple, just a hard tiled floor. They were doing building work in that monastery, so there's like jackhammers going, jang, 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 and machines and everything. And lots of mosquitoes around, biting him. And when he told me this story, you could see this change that came over him when he told the story. He said, I went inside one la. And he had this profound experience. He didn't know what he was doing. He didn't know how he did it. He could never do it again. He said, no, I can't do anything. But he had a profound experience in meditation. Why? Because he let go. Yeah. So this is why I find this story of the young Buddha to be. You know, he's obviously was a highly precocious child and very very gifted. And just going into meditation naturally, I find it very believable. And I think it tells us something profound about the nature of meditation. Yeah? Meditation is not a specific, like a spiritual technology that you can only attain by doing a particular method or something like that. It is something that I think people generally get into these kinds of things, you know? I heard another story was this Maori guy who used to come and hang around Bodhnyana some time ago. I haven't seen him for a while, but he used to come around. And formerly he was a hunter in New Zealand. And he said he was out hunting for deer or something like this. But hunters have to be very mindful. And he was just sitting there waiting in the forest and just like went into samadhi. Same thing. You know, he had this powerful experience. Why? How? He doesn't know. And then that sent him on his spiritual search. And I'm guessing that people all around the world in all different backgrounds and cultures or whatever have experienced these things. But of course, you experience them, but you can't necessarily make sense of them. And you don't really know what to do with them. It's just a weird experience. You know, you remember it or whatever, but you know, you can't get back there. And as soon as you start to think about it, you think about it as a place you want to get back to. But of course, it isn't a place you want to get back to. It's letting go. And as soon as you want to get back to it, you can't. So I think most of the time it just gets filed away as being one of those things, which of course is what the Buddha did for many years. Now then later on, he grew dissatisfied with his home life. I won't go through all of the details of the Buddha's life story. That would take me a very long time. But anyway, he left home in the north of the India and travelled south, seeking for that which is beyond birth, aging and death. He didn't know what that was, but he knew that that's what he was looking for. Now, in those days in India, there were, as today, spiritual seekers, gurus, teachers, methods, systems, practitioners of all kinds, all over the place. And of course, India has always been, well, I don't know about always been, but certainly for a very long time, has been a hotbed of spiritual experimentation and development and practice. So the Buddha travelled south. He went to Rajagaha, which is south of the Ganges River, not too far south. In these days it's called Rajgir. And it's a city which was surrounded by a range of hills. And in those hills, much like in the hills here, there were all of these meditators, hermits, practitioners, and so on and so forth. And he went and stayed with a number of these different teachers. So the first teacher he went to stay with was a fellow by the name of Alara Kalama. And Alara Kalama accepted him as a student. He had an ashram and he had a community there. And the bodhisattva, that is the one who's seeking for enlightenment, began by studying and learning to recite by oral recitation the scriptures of that particular tradition. Now, in the sutta that tells this story, it doesn't tell us what those texts are, but we can infer that they must have been the Vedic scriptures of the Brahmanical tradition, and in particular, the texts of what we call today the Upanishads. And I won't go into detail about the historical kind of background to that, but that's an area of research that I've been doing for the last few years. So these are the scriptures that the Buddha learned when he first went there. Now this is already telling us something, because when he first went to meditate, he didn't learn any scriptures, didn't have to do any preparation, didn't have to do anything. He just went into samadhi. And now he's learning all of these texts. Okay? And learning the Vedic texts, not easy, I'd have to say. These are very expansive texts, very difficult, very complex, and in some cases very philosophically profound. It's a large variety of texts in that tradition. We don't know exactly what the ones he learned were, but we do have some idea because some of them are referred to in places in the suttas themselves. So I'm just going to give you a little bit of background as to what this tradition was that the Buddha first learned. Of course, many of you have some familiarity with it because I've spoken to a number of people in the interviews and they come from like a Vedic background or a yoga background, or they've practiced with different people who've been teaching in these traditions. And this is similar to the tradition of the Upanishads and the modern Advaita traditions. All draw on the teachings of the Upanishads in various ways. So very briefly, the history of these things is that long before the Buddha, say 1,000 years before the Buddha or so, they formed a corpus of texts called the Vedas, especially the Rig Veda. And the Rig Veda is mostly hymns of homage to various gods which embody forces of nature. And there was a specialized class of priests who memorized these things and passed them down. Vedic literature is very interesting, but I won't dwell on it too much. Most of the Vedas don't really have anything to do with meditation. But there are some things which we can learn from it. One thing in particular which I think is interesting is that one of the main Vedic gods was the god Indra. Yeah? And Indra's whole thing was to march around with a thunderbolt slaying dragons. Indra was quite a famous god, and in fact, I believe he might have taken a holiday even as far as Norway, where he was known locally as Thor, perhaps. Yeah? The gods of the Norse and Greek pantheons are ultimately derived from the same source as the Vedic deities. So Indra, we call Saka in the suttas. Perhaps we should even translate Saka as Thor. Oh, now that I'm thinking about that, the more I think about it, the more I think it's a good idea. You'll have to remind me tomorrow to restrain myself and not go through the whole of Sutta Central and just call Saka Thor through the whole thing, because it could be fun. Anyway, moving along. Fine. So he used to do all of this great stuff like slaying dragons and all of this kind of thing. Fine. But how did he do that? What was it that allowed him to have the power to do that? Well, like many blokes who get a bit violent when they go drinking in the pub, Indra had to have a bit of a drink before he would go slaying dragons or whatnot. And the drink he would have was soma. Yeah? And soma, it was some kind of milky substance which was consumed in the ritual. We don't really know exactly what it was, but in my opinion, most likely it was ephedra, which is a kind of stimulant from the amphetamine family. So Indra would have this soma, and then he would manifest his Indrianess. He would manifest the true potential of his nature, and then he would go on a rampage and slay dragons and so on. And that Indrianess, that manifestation of his true power, is called the Indriya. Yeah? Indriya. So in Buddhism, we also have the word Indriya. Yeah? Indriya is the spiritual faculties or spiritual powers. And in fact, those very same group of spiritual faculties or spiritual powers were taught to the Bodhisattva by his first teacher. Faith, energy, mindfulness, samadhi, and wisdom. So this is, I think, one point of connection. I'll come back to that just in a minute. So anyway, the first point is that the Buddha went to Larakalama, he studied the scriptures. He learned all of these Vedas, and he learned these Upanishads. Now, the Upanishads are very different literature to the Vedas. The Upanishads are contemplative and reflective and philosophical literature. And the most important sage of the Upanishads was named Yajnavalkya. And Yajnavalkya was responsible for many, I think, of the most profound sayings in spiritual history. And he said that his quest that he was looking for, he described it as the unseen seer, the unheard hearer, the unthought thinker, the unknown knower. Yeah? So you can hear from the way that he's talking about things that he's moving to quite a profound inner contemplation. And he talked about letting go of everything. Yajnavalkya's method was very much about letting go and not identifying with things. One of his most famous phrases, neti, neti, not that, not that. Yeah. Not that, not that, not that. Letting go of everything. And once you've let go of everything, what remains? Vijnanaganameva, that sheer mass of consciousness. And so Yajnavalkya identified his true, eternal, pure self as that sheer mass of infinite consciousness, which is identical with the divinity that manifests the whole universe. And this is the core of the Upanishadic teaching. And this, I believe, is what the Buddha was studied under Larakalama. Now, this is a very beautiful teaching. And many of you have studied and practiced in traditions that teach something very similar. And personally, I think that apart from Buddhism, it's the most beautiful and profound spiritual philosophy that there is. I think it's an amazing idea, and we need to sort of just stop and contemplate how profound it is to realize that that consciousness which is inside you is the same as the essence of divinity of the whole cosmos. It's an incredible kind of insight. And the way that Yajnavalkya talked and the way that other other philosophers and sages of his time were thinking about this, it was very evocative, quite moving, and quite esoteric. Like that tradition valued, like they have a saying, the gods love hidden things. So they always, or everything was like a bit obscure. Actually, a lot obscure, and everything was hidden under layers of meaning and metaphor. No? I believe this is one of the reasons why the Buddha's teachings are very clear. I think he was kind of reacting against that Vedic tendency to hide things, and he wanted to lay things out very neatly. So the Buddha learnt all of this stuff, and he said, that's great. And then he said, okay, I've developed and I've practiced, and there he mentioned those five things that we today call the indriyas, faith, energy, mindfulness, samadhi, and wisdom. Yeah? Faith, sadha, yes, faith, energy, mindfulness, samadhi and wisdom. Interesting that mindfulness is there, because these days everybody says, well, mindfulness is this quintessential Buddhist thing. But the Buddha says quite clearly he learned mindfulness from his former teachers. So these five spiritual faculties are the five qualities which empower you and which allow you to fully realize your spiritual potential and to realize awakening. When, much later, when the Buddha became enlightened, then when he wanted to know who he should first teach, he used his psychic abilities to know who had the spiritual potential for awakening. And the word that's used there is that indriya, the same word. So that indriya is something which lies within each of you. All of you have some faith. If you didn't have any faith, you wouldn't be here. You all have some energy, yes? If you didn't have any energy, you'd be asleep, right? You all have some mindfulness. Right? We all have some samadhi, we have some tranquility and peace of mind, we all have some wisdom. These are human capacities that we all have, and which through our practice of the Dhamma, then we can manifest as the indriya. So we don't have to take drugs to do it, yeah? Instead we do meditation. We don't have to take the soma, we have the meditation. And so the Buddha said, well, this Alaraka Lama, he has these five faculties and so do I. So I'm guessing he's not just talking about what's in the books. He's talking about something that he's realized and seen for himself. And so he asked Alaraka Lama this, what have you seen for yourself? And he said a meditation called the dimension of nothingness. Now, I'm not going to kind of go into this again in too much detail, but again, this is a kind of meditation which is mentioned in the Brahmanical texts as well. So this is a very profound level of meditation. And so the Bodhisattva said, okay, if you can do it, I can do it too. And so he went and meditated and realized that same state of meditation and spoke to Alaraka Lama, who confirmed that it was his same state of meditation. And then Alaraka Lama said, well, why don't we lead this community together? We've now realized this same thing. Let's lead the community together. It's a very gracious thing to do, right? It's not normal. It's not common that a spiritual teacher would be like, oh, yeah, you've got really good meditation. Why don't you come and be the co-teacher? Yeah. And this is a sign that of his integrity as a spiritual teacher and a sign of the Buddha's confidence in him. So after the Buddha was enlightened, he wanted to first teach Alaraka Lama and Udakaramaputta because he said they had little dust in their eyes. So they're very close, yeah? Very close. It's a very profound teaching. I think it's really important to fully appreciate the profundity of what was going on here. The Buddha wasn't just sort of going out and hanging out at his local meditation center and, you know, doing a bit of light meditation here and there. He was finding the greatest sages of his time and practicing until he had realized the same level that they had. And then he thought about that and thought, well, where does this lead? And he realized that this leads to that dimension of consciousness based on nothingness, which leads to a rebirth that lasts for millions of eons and yet doesn't lead beyond rebirth. It's still connected to being. It's still connected to existence. And he recollected the reason why he had gone forth was to find that which is beyond birth, aging and death. And he realized that this Dhamma is not good enough. It's not for me. So he left. He traveled to find another teacher called Udakaramaputta, and under him he took studentship, practiced, and realized an even higher state of meditation, even beyond what Udakaramaputta had realized. Still not satisfied, and so he left that. Continued his search for that which is beyond birth, aging and death. So in the bare details of the Buddha's search so far, we've kind of learned quite a bit about his character. Obviously very skilled at meditation, obviously very adept at learning these different practices. But equally, obviously, he was very driven, you know. It's this quality of like not stopping, which to me is really one of the things that's most memorable about him. And I think just to sort of pause for a minute and reflect about on ourselves, about where we are in our spiritual path and where we are aiming. And I understand that for many people, maybe you're not here to find that which is beyond birth, aging and death. Maybe you don't even have any clue what that would mean. Yeah. But I want you to just reflect that whatever it is that's driving your spiritual path, don't forget it. Don't lose sight of that. Don't become just satisfied with what's second best. In fact, when we take our ordination, or particularly in the Chinese tradition, usually the ordination procedures for the different traditions are very similar. But in the Chinese tradition, from the Dharmaguptaka Vinaya, they have a line there that we don't have in our Pali Vinaya. And it says, when you ordain, you say something like, may I not forget the inspiration which led me to take the going forth. So that's, I think, something that's really important for all of us to remember. Some of you here have been meditating for many years. Some have meditated long ago, given it up, and then come back and starting again. Some have been practicing regularly for a long time. Some are just new to the practice. But for all of us, we're going to have to find some way to continue that practice in a way that is going to nourish and develop and help us to grow over a long time. So don't forget why you came here. Don't forget what it is that's driving you. And even though we might say that's for different things, right? You might say, oh, I want to help to overcome my anxiety or whatever reason that it might be that you've come. Ultimately, if you look deep enough, we all want to be free. Yeah? Inside ourselves, we all want to be free. And this is one of the core principles behind metta meditation, because you're connecting with that desire for all of us to be happy. There's a story about one of the monks who I know, Venerable Kirupa Gaudiñānānanda. I spent some time with him in India one time, and he went to, we were staying at Bodh Gaya where the Buddha was enlightened. And he went on a day trip to Rajagaha, as it happens, the same place where the Buddha was practicing. And if you've been around to the Buddhist holy sites in India, you'll know that there's lots of these little beggar kids who are around asking for money and so on. And when they see the monks, they're always like, baba, baba, bakshish, bakshish. And all of the local people will tell you, don't give the kids any money, they should be at school. But they don't go to school because they make more money from the tourists. Anyway, so this kid was coming along, baba, baba, bakshish, bakshish. And, just a skinny little poor kid. And he came along to Bhante Nyanananda. And Nyanananda kind of looked at him and he sort of took pity on him, put his hand on his head and said to him in Hindi, he's learned Hindi, and he said to him in Hindi, don't you want to be free from all of this suffering? And this little boy just looked at him and tears filled his eyes. And he fell down and bowed at this monk's feet and said, yes, please help me, please help me. Please help me find freedom from all of this suffering. It's in all of us, somehow, this wish to be free. And some way, I believe that our spiritual journey is pulling us towards that freedom. So the Buddha wouldn't give up. Most of us would be pretty happy if we were told, okay, you get to exist in a plane of unadulterated bliss for like a trillion eons. And we'd be like, oh, yes, that doesn't sound too bad. It's like a consolation prize, you know. But he was like, no, that's not good enough. So he went on, kept on practicing. What to do now? So then he fell in with another group of practitioners who were from like the second great strain of spiritual practitioners in ancient India. So typically we divide the spiritual practitioners at the time into two groups, the Brahmins who practice from the Vedic tradition, that's who the Buddha practiced with first, and then the Shramana traditions, of which the Jains are the most well-known and the most prominent and the only one which has survived to the present day. So the Buddha practiced with a group of five ascetics who are from the Jain tradition, or at least something very like the Jain tradition. So I don't know if anybody here is familiar with the Jain tradition, still a very vital tradition in India today. We have, where I live in Harris Park in Sydney, we have some Jains in the local area. one of the most prominent features of Jain philosophy is non-harming. And one of the ways that we got to know one of our local Jain families was because every night or most nights you can see them in the backyard of their flats where they take their little bunny rabbits and they bring them down onto the grass and sit them there and just sit beside the bunny rabbits as they play on the grass and just looking after them, because that's their practice of non-harming. So the Jains had a very, what from a modern point of view can seem like a very strange set of beliefs. I don't want to kind of go into their beliefs in too much detail, but they believed something like this. They believed that each of us has an individual eternal soul. Unlike the Upanishadic view, which is that we have like a cosmic soul, like we are a node of cosmic divinity. The Jains said we have separate individual souls, which are eternal, but they have been clouded by defilements. They've been polluted. And so these polluted souls have to be purified. And we purify them through the practice of tapas. Tapas is not a Spanish dish. Well, it is, but that's not what we're referring to here. Tapas is the tapas literally means heat or fire. And it was the kinds of practices that you would do that would create like a literal physical fire inside your body that would burn off all of these defilements and purify your eternal soul. And so they would do various kinds of ascetic practices in order to create that inner fire. And those practices the Buddha undertook for a number of years. And they include things like fasting until you starve yourself nearly to death. In fact, Jains do in fact starve themselves to death at the last stage of their life. The Jain monks and nuns have a practice of starving themselves to death. They're called salekana. Or other practices might be like standing on one leg. Right, so you have to stand on one leg for like 6 months at a time or something like that. Or you have to like stand with one arm in the air, which you think is really difficult until you see somebody who's standing with two arms in the air. And you're thinking, it's like, there's a lot of questions about exactly how you do that for a long period of time. The more you start to think about it, the more difficult then... more issues that raises. I think a lot of them were not doing things that were that extreme, but they certainly had a very strict rule. For example, one of the rules that they were supposed to keep for the monks and nuns, the monks weren't supposed to wear clothes for a start, so that's challenging. And they also were not supposed to bathe, also challenging. Yeah, you might be surprised to know Jains have a little bit of difficulty in recruiting monks and nuns these days. It's also why you don't see a lot of Jain monks overseas. They have difficulty getting on airplanes. So they followed these very strict rules. Other rules they had, they would wear like a mask, like the masks that we wear for COVID, and then they would have a soft brush that they would brush the path in front to make sure there weren't any ants on the ground. Right? So that's a practice of non-harming. So there are many of these rules which were, you know, on when you take them by themselves, they seem kind of quite bizarre, rules and practices and so on. But they do stem from a very, from a coherent and quite deeply considered philosophy. So the Buddha practiced with these people for a number of years and did all of these ascetic practices and basically at the end of it decided this is a waste of time. Now, this is also something which is very important to remember. Some of the people in the interviews have asked me about, they've been on retreats where it's like super hardcore and you're having to get up really early and they're like, you meditate, and it's like really painful, and then they're like, you know, lean into the pain, burn off your karma and all of these kinds of things. I don't know, I kind of feel that it can edge over into these kind of self-torment things. If it's taken to extreme, I'm not saying it is, I'm just saying just be a bit careful with those things. Certainly one teaching, which is a Jain teaching that's quite common in Buddhism today, is people believe that everything's determined by karma, right? This is something people say quite commonly in Buddhism. Everything's determined by karma. This was a Jain belief. And the Buddha argued with the Jains about it, a number of suttas where he took the Jains on, and he said, you believe everything is caused by karma? They said, yes. Then he said, well, why are you doing this practice? Right? Because if you're doing this practice to end karma, then the practice is just caused by karma anyway, so you don't have any choice. And I said, well, this is what we were told to do, so we're doing it. Anyway, so from the Buddha's point of view was that karma is a force of nature which works in relation with all of the other forces of nature. Karma doesn't determine everything about your life. It doesn't fix, karma doesn't have fixed results. Karma is an influence that works together with everything else, right? I mean, it isn't the case that these days, you know, why do we all have smartphones? Well, it isn't the case that, you know, in some past life we all did smartphone having karma, and then spontaneously it just happens that we've got smartphones, right? I mean, it's not how it works. Yeah. It works together with all of the other, you know, the weather and the, you know, biology and the economics and all of the other things which are all a part of it. So this is one of the philosophical differences that the Buddha had from the Jains. So after deciding that all of this was a waste of time, now again, I think this is really an interesting juncture in the Buddha's life, because it's not easy to make that kind of decision. We have what we call the sunk cost fallacy. Yeah? You know that what the sunk cost fallacy. In fact, the sunk cost fallacy is talked about explicitly, I believe, for the first time in world literature in the suttas. The Payasi Sutta actually has the metaphor where you're going from village to village and you're picking up stuff, and then you pick up like a bale of hay, and then you go to the next village and then there's some cloth. And so one of them says, oh, I'm going to put down my bale of hay and pick up the cloth because it's more valuable. And the other one says, well, no, I've carried my hay this far, I'm going to keep carrying it. So they go from village to village, and it goes from hay to then to silver and then to gold. And then one of them ends up with a sack of gold and the other's got a bale of hay. They get home. Have to explain to their wives why one of them's got a bag of gold and one of them's got a bale of hay. So that was an awkward conversation. But this is the sunk cost fallacy, and which I believe that's the first time in world literature that actually explicitly explains that. Anyway. So it's difficult from a spiritual point of view to actually admit that you are wrong. Yeah? And another aspect of it is like confirmation bias. And we're all going to be guilty of that. You come on retreat. Nobody wants to come on retreat and say, oh, yeah, that was a waste of time. Oh, yeah, I did all this meditation. It's completely useless. So if somebody comes to me and says, and I, you know, I say, how was your meditation? They said, it was a complete waste of time. I'm like, oh, that's fantastic. To me, that's really great if somebody says it's a waste of time, because they're being honest about it. Yeah. But 6 years, right? 6 years the Buddha did a dedicated practice, enduring all of this stuff, and only to turn around and say, no, waste of time. Dedication. So then what do you do? Then he's gone beyond all of these different teachings, all of these different philosophies. And again, I just want to emphasize how profound and meaningful all these different philosophies are. And that was a really golden age of philosophy and practice in ancient India. And all of the, you know, the many philosophies and things which have come later all hark back to that era. And yet even then, the Buddha said, no, it's not good enough. So the first thing he said, you know, what am I going to do? So he made his way down to the place that we call today Bodh Gaya. Now, in the way that this is depicted in the suttas, it seems like it happened overnight, but it didn't really. Actually, there are other suttas where the Buddha talks about developing meditation over a considerable period of time. And in those suttas, it gives you some examples of how he went on to develop meditation. But what we do know for sure is that from this period, he did not follow any particular path. He was not doing what some teacher told, and he was not following some method. He was finding out for himself. This is really important. This is crucially important. We have to find out for ourselves. Yeah? We have to find out for ourselves. And I'm going to say to you right now, if you ever hear a meditation teacher or practitioner who, and all they can do is parrot what their tradition has told them, no, sorry, You have to say, you have to find things out for yourself. You have to have something to say for yourself. It's okay to respect your tradition and to convey your tradition. That's one thing. But insight and meaning comes from you, not from what somebody has told you. And so this is the point where the Buddha was like, okay, I have to find things for myself. Oh, one detail. Sorry, I should go back. One detail just to mention that I mentioned that under his Brahmin teachers that he learnt sati or mindfulness. But it also says that when he was doing those Jain practices as well, it also said that he was very mindful in stepping forward and stepping back so that he wouldn't harm any of the little creatures. So it seems that mindfulness was in fact a commonly accepted practice among the spiritual practitioners of the time. So what did he do? Well, he recalled that time when he was a boy and he'd sat down under the rose apple tree and had entered into first jhana. And he asked himself, why am I afraid of that pleasure? Because it has nothing to do with desires and attachments. Remember that under the Jains, they were taught to repudiate any form of pleasure. Yeah? Only pain. Pain is the way. By means of pain, you arrive at pleasure. And he thought, but actually that pleasure of meditation, what's wrong with that? That pleasure actually only came from letting go. And he wondered to himself whether that could be the path to awakening. And that insight came to him. That indeed is the path to awakening. Eso vamago bodhaya. Eso vamago bodhaya. This indeed is the path to awakening. Then he thought, okay, so I'm going to have to eat some food, get healthy, develop my meditation so that I can realize that state again. So that's what he did. Of course, there's a crucial difference in the meditation that he had as a kid to the meditation he had under the Brahmins or under the Jains, and that is that it wasn't part of any system. He didn't have any theory. He wasn't trying to get anything. He was just being peaceful, and the meditation was natural. It just came. So then he went on to develop his practice. A number of suttas that talk about this, they're quite interesting. I won't go into them in too much detail. One of those suttas, he talks about how he's meditating in the forest, and it was a very scary night. And he was in the jungle, and it was really dark, and he heard a crack of a twig, and he thought, oh my God, what's that? Is that a lion? Is it a bear? Oh, no, it's only a peacock. And he had to deal with those fears that he was facing from meditating. I love that Buddha. That's my Buddha. Yeah, I don't like the Buddha who was kind of born and was like walking around on lotuses and there were showers of stuff from the sky and all of these kinds of things. Too much like CGI. I don't like it. I like the Buddha who tried to meditate but was too scared because he thought it was a lion and it was actually a peacock. To me, that sounds relatable. And he persevered. Yeah? He overcame. He said, that's that fear. Ah, I recognize that fear has a cause. I can contemplate that and I can let that go. And he learned how to let that go. Another sutta, the Dwedha Vitaka Sutta, talks about how he overcame distracting thoughts. Also a good one. I like it. I'm sure everybody here can relate. You're sitting here wondering, oh my God, I'm supposed to be meditating and all I'm doing is thinking about all of this stuff. The Buddha did exactly the same thing and had to go through that same practice in his meditation. And so when he was doing this, he's developing his understanding of his own mind. And he thought, well, all of these thoughts that are happening. He said, well, first of all, maybe I can distinguish between thoughts that are wholesome and thoughts that are unwholesome, and leave off those thoughts that are unwholesome. Yeah? You can see that even in that very simple idea is the characteristic of the Buddha's teaching. It's very rational, it's very scientific, and it's very experiential. Okay, let's try this out and see where this leads. For those of you who have jobs and have to try to practice Dhamma in daily life, there's a nice story about doing that exact practice in daily life. And that's a story from a man who later became known as the monk Upagupta. So when Upagupta was a young man, he was working at a, it's about 100 years after the Buddha, he was working at a store, and a monk used to come for alms around every day, a monk called Channavasin. Channavasin used to come for alms, and Upagupta would give him the things. And then eventually Upagupta wanted to become a monk. He said, "Can I become a monk?" And Channavasin said, "No, you're not ready." He said, "Well, how can I become ready?" He said, "You have to train your mind." He said, "How do I train my mind? I'm busy working in the shop all day." He said, "Well, do this. You get two piles of stones, white pebbles and black pebbles. Every time you have a bad thought, you put a black pebble in the pile. And every time you have a good thought, you put a white pebble in the pile." Interesting practice, because it's very practical, but it's also very non-judgmental. He's not saying you're bad because you have bad thoughts or anything. He's saying, let's put a thing in the pile. Have an angry thought, just put a pebble in the pile. So he said, okay, that's easy, I can do that. So the next day he did that practice and then was very embarrassed, because by the time Channavasin came around, there's a big pile of black pebbles and only one or two white ones. Shanawasin's like, okay. So let's see. So he kept on doing that practice day after day after day until eventually there was a pile of only white pebbles and no black ones. And then Channavasin said, okay, now you want to ordain, you can come. So this is essentially the practice that the Buddha did at this point in his life. And he overcame those unwholesome thoughts, and his mind was filled with thoughts of metta, thoughts of letting go, thoughts of compassion. But then he thought to himself, I could keep on thinking these thoughts of love and compassion all day and it would never cause any harm. But at the same time, my mind wouldn't be really peaceful. And I wouldn't realize samadhi. So I have to be able to take that deeper into samadhi. And there is another sutta that talks about how he did that. That's called the Upakilesa Sutta, which talks about how he saw these lights in his meditation and how he had these different visions and how all of these different kinds of hindrances would distract him or would cause those lights and visions to fade away. But again, he persevered, managed to overcome all of those and to develop his meditation. So this is a very kind of brief summary of this. But you can see how this is like the final stage in the Buddha's practice. And so he began by seeking for an answer without knowing how to find it. Right? When he went out on a spiritual quest, the word that he described the word that describes that spiritual quest is King Kusala Gavesi, which is an interesting phrase. King Kusala Gavesi literally means seeking an answer to the question, what is the good? Yeah, King Kusala, what is good? Yeah. So then he practiced with the Brahman teachers, learnt the Vedas and the Upanishads, learnt the profound meditations there. But because those profound meditations were within that particular philosophy, they led to a state of rebirth. They didn't lead to full letting go. Then he practiced with the Jains, and there he learnt about non-harming, learnt about being mindful in all of his daily actions. But he also was wrapped up in these ideas of self-torment and so on. So he left that behind as well. And then he had to find his own path. And it was when he found his own path that he learnt little bit by little bit to experiment, to learn to understand his own mind, to refine his thoughts, to refine his mind, ultimately to develop deep states of meditation and to have an insight into the Four Noble Truths. And so when he was ready, he went to Bodh Gaya, where he sat on the bank of the Uruvela River and meditated all night. And that night is celebrated in the Buddhist tradition as the night of Vesak, the full moon of Vesak, in which the Buddha attained full enlightenment. Shortly afterwards, when he was asked about his practice, he was asked, like, who was your teacher under whom you attained enlightenment? And he said, Acharya me nati, I have no teacher. And so even though there were people who supported him and guided him at various stages on his path, the crucial development was something that he found for himself. So that puts us in a kind of odd situation, doesn't it? Because we are the followers of the one who had no follower. We're the students of the teacher who did not have a teacher. Yeah. And in a way, we are put into that same paradox that the Buddha himself was put into. If you just follow and do not inquire, do not find out for yourself, then you will never really know. Your mind will always be trapped in the words and trapped in the ideas and trapped in the doctrines and trapped in the dogmas. And these days, of course, it's very easy to find people who are really into that. And if you want to find like online communities of people who argue about meditation and argue about Nibbana and argue about enlightenment and so on, it's very easy to find that kind of thing. I find it a bit boring personally. I like to argue about different kinds. I don't really actually like to argue about things, but I think there are things we can have discussions about. But I think those kinds of discussions are really kind of missing the point a lot of the time. The point is not what is enlightenment, what is, you know, Nibbana or anything like that. The point is, what is my next step? The point is, this unwholesome thought I have, how can I let go of that? And that is what leads us ultimately to Nibbana. So this is a few thoughts for you today on the topic of how the Buddha learned to meditate. And I would like to encourage all of you to, you know, to reflect on that and think about that. And just to bear in mind that while we learn from our teachers and we learn from our traditions, we have to find our own truth and our own freedom. And nobody else can give that to us.